May it please the Court, Andrew Love for the appellants, Joseph Curry, City of Miami Firefighters, and Police Officers of Fire Trust. The issue of this appeal is whether appellants sufficiently pled securities fraud based on Yelp's statements about the credibility of their reviews, which is their only product, as they say, their entire value proposition, and their denial of any relationship between businesses paying for advertisements and the quality of reviews. An unusual feature of this case, and what I think that is helpful in assessing the plausibility of the allegations, is that we have analyst reactions in real time to the developing story of the FTC disclosures of Yelp complaints beginning on the morning of April 2nd, 2014, when a media began to leak the news that the Wall Street Journal was going to publish an article about the FTC disclosures. For the next day, as his complaints were reviewed and digested. And if I could briefly outline this timeline, I think it would be helpful to show what the market understood with my disclosures in real time.
Okay, that's fine. But can I just tell you from my own standpoint, before your time runs out, I'd really like to hear your response to the loss causation argument. I know you get to that last year, but I want to start with that first. And I'm sort of inclined to think your opponent is right on that. So I just want to ensure at some point you get to loss causation.
In fact, I believe that the timeline will show that the market's reaction and the analyst's reaction to the disclosure in real time shows that
that's not the problem with your loss causation argument, of course, right? I don't want to get you off track. If you want to go through the timeline, that's fine, but I'm going to be waiting to hear what you just said about loss causation. I'm just telling you that.
I'm happy to talk about loss causation.
Okay, so this seems to me is an insurmountable barrier for your argument here, because there we said that the disclosure of an investigation alone, right, is never going to be enough. You've got to have something more. And here it seems to me you've got something less. You don't even have the disclosure of an investigation by the FTC. They're not, at least that was the fact that was publicly revealed. All that was revealed is that the FTC kind of collated a bunch of complaints from folks. So it's not even, it doesn't even rise to the level of any kind of a formal government investigation. So how could that possibly be enough on your list? That's where I get
stuck. So, in this, what the court said was that the launch of an investigation wasn't enough because the market could not have any idea of what the investigation could disclose. And I would say, Your Honor, that here what we have is actually the fruits of the investigation that we had more. That we don't just have FTC disclosure of a number of complaints, but here we have sort of the fruits of that investigation. We have
there was no conclusion reached. All it was a bunch of people that complained. And lodged complaints, there had been no determination by the FTC, correct me if I'm wrong, that in fact the complaints had merit, and that in fact there was some company-wide practice that was inconsistent with the representations that had been made, was there?
Right, Your Honor, but I don't believe that the conclusion by an agency about establishing fraud is necessary for loss causation. It's just a proximate cause between the statements, alleged misstatements, and a reaction by the market. And here we have,
you've got to have a revelation of facts to show that the representations that the company was making are not true. And here, it's not like, if the company had said in its public statements, not only do we not engage in these despicable practices, but we've never received a single complaint from anybody that we've done that. We've got a pristine record. Nobody's even complained about that. If they had said that, and then it was disclosed that actually 2,000 plus people have complained, that would be different, right? But in fact, what they disclosed was, yeah, people have been complaining about this for a while. We certainly deny it. We don't think there's merit to those complaints. And so the mere disclosure that, well, actually, yeah, we have an exact number of the complaints that have been lodged with one particular government agency doesn't seem to me that shows that the statements that the company made are false.
I think what's correct here is the fact that the company did say that these complaints were untrue, that there was absolutely no relationship. And at the beginning stage here, we have a plausible case given the number of complaints that are consistent across the country. A majority of 2,046 complaints stating that Yelp representatives would call up businesses as soon as the businesses denied agreeing to pay for advertising. Good reviews would disappear, bad reviews would show up. This is across the country, a consistent story
from counsel. Judge Gould, if I could interject a question. There are a lot of people selling this advertising around the world, right?
Correct.
A lot of offices. And those people doing the sales, they're presumably chained up in some way by the company. But were there any allegations in the complaint? Because I didn't notice this, that some executive had said and would testify that they were training people to extort funds from people for advertising revenue under the threat of bad reviews.
No, there's nothing explicit about that, although the inference that was happening based on the number of complaints and as an appellee's brief, pages 15 and 16, they disclose or could see that there are 30 Yelp representatives who claim that they told business owners that there was a connection between paying for advertising and quality of reviews. So that's 30 there that corroborate the other 2,000 complaints, which possibly suggests that this was going on nationwide, and that these 30, and then there's the 2,046, these two measures where the Yelp representatives are named, which shows that it is a problem. The inference is that this is a company-wide policy, given that this is happening in different parts of the country. So this is
sort of a related question on that point is, did the FTC ever send a subpoena to Yelp asking them for PowerPoint presentations or videos or evidence of how they trained their marketing people?
I don't know of any actions by the FTC, but what we do have, and I think this case is closer to the Lloyd versus CPB case, where initially there is, that case it was a subpoena, and an analyst assumed that there was an issue in that case, just subsequently confirmed. Here what we have are these complaints, and then as the analysts review these complaints, it became clear that this was a major problem, as well as Wells Fargo predicted 2 days before the revelations. They said, yes, there are these complaints out there, denies the complaints, but if there's a growing number of businesses that come to the conclusion that this is a problem, then Yelp's business is going to suffer. It's actually that a growing number of complaints can alter the total mix of the information available, and that's exactly what happened. And so you have this timeline where beginning of the morning of April 2nd, as these FTC disclosures are being leaked, such as in the morning there's a leak by what Bloomberg discusses, the FTC disclosures, that the Wall Street Journal is going to write an article, the stock starts to come down.
Well, at that point, there at least in the press, there hadn't been any disclosure of the content of it.
Correct.
So I don't see how that gets you anywhere. That initial 6% drop, that is continuous.
Well, so then as that evening and the next day, as the complaints were scrutinized, and analysts were saying, now that we have looked at these complaints, we know that a majority of them are about this manipulation of reviews. And so it confirms the initial understanding that the complaints. And in fact, one of the media reports that you referred from the street says, right, we don't know what the complaints are yet. But given the past complaints about manipulation, there's this presumption that that's what it's about, and then in fact that's confirmed that evening of the next day, which is also part of the loss causation that the judge Tiger's focus on April 2nd, but it's important that the loss causation claim also involves April 3rd. As the complaints were digested by the market, and the market understands that, in fact, this is a problem, and it doesn't require
anything else that explains that result. Excuse me, is there anything else that explains that result? Anything else in the record that would be an explanation for the drop?
There's nothing else in the record. And every analyst, the analysts that looked at this, both on April 2nd, April 3rd, April 4th, as the stock continues to go down, the market understood that the problem was that there was a sufficient number of consistent corroborating complaints that this was a problem, and it didn't require a government finding of fraud.
So what, coming to say, let's say that instead of the disclosure of this database of complaints, let's say that on April 2nd, the FTC itself had come in and said, people, we've received a large volume of complaints about this particular type of misconduct at Yale. We opened a formal investigation. We'll get back to you in 6 months. Right? Stock price. That would be just like this, right? And you would concede that you've just been serious. It's not this.
I think the difference with these, with Metzler, take my
hypothetical. I'm not going to answer my hypothetical. That case that I just described would be covered by the rules of this. If you were the plaintiff there, you would lose, right?
Yes, well, the difference, I think,
that's okay. I'm trying to understand your I'm trying to understand how you think the hypothetical I pose is any different. I think it's actually a stronger case for the plaintiff than the one that you have that I'm trying to get. Because that's why you. Where am I going wrong?
Okay, I think that the difference is a loss of investigation as it leads. It's a sort of a preliminary indication, as they say, that the market has no idea what will be found. It's sort of before you have all these complaints.
Let's say the FTC announces, though, doesn't disclose the database, but just says we've received a large volume of complaints about this specific type of misconduct, and the reason is the thinking the company might have engaged in. And therefore, on the basis of this large volume of complaints, we've launched a formal investigation.
Right.
It seems to me that is exactly what this is talking about. It says it's insufficient without something more.
Right. And I think what we have more is what happens with the CBD, where you have a large investigation for the number of complaints, and then the market speculation that this is actually a problem is confirmed once the complaints.
Council said a launch of investigation with a bunch of complaints, but I thought the agency, the FTC, never launched an investigation that received complaints, but they didn't open a formal charge or proceeding.
It's not on the record whether they did or not. There's nothing in the record that says that they did. I would point out footnote 5, I believe, in Parafone, which says that a launch of an investigation by the SEC is not relevant. The issue is, at the pleading stage, we showed enough that this is company-wide policy, this is an isolated incident, and that the defendant's statements are plausibly false and material, and that once the revelation of the falsity was disclosed by these consistent corroborative complaints, and the stock drops, it's a substantial cost of the drop at the pleading stage.
Let me suggest this. I'm sorry if I got sidetracked on loss causation. You should take the rest of your time to address the other issues. You've got to win on all of them, and I'll give you additional time for taking it.
So I think for materiality, we have, and Emma said, this is the Yelp's only product, and the credibility of their reviews, as they say, is an entire value proposition. They have prominently on their website the common questions, the zero relationship, and so, and they warn that this is a problem. So this is a critical issue for them. And as Wells Fargo pointed out 2 days before, if there's a growing number of complaints, this is going to alter the total piece of information. So I think materiality is shown there, especially by. I don't need to go with the timeline now, but it shows that the analysts in real time understood that this was a huge problem for Yelp. And in terms of Scienter, we have, again, this is their only product. They're on notice that there are these allegations about manipulation, talking about lawsuits, prior media reports. And they make statements that certainly indicate that they're in a position to know that this is what they say is a true zero relationship. And this is one of those cooperations inferences where, given how important this issue was, it's the only issue the company has, and it would be absurd to suggest that the defendants were not aware of the problem. So, those are the conditions.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Let's hear from the council for the defendant.
All right,
morning, ma'am. Please support Dennis Scrota of Arnold & Porter Case Shoulder for the Yelp defendants. Before I come to the loss causation, which I think is a showstopper here, let me put a little bit of this in perspective. Okay? In front of Judge Tiger at the lower court was undisputed evidence about the size and scope of Yelp. Yelp operated an online platform where any member of the public could post a review of a restaurant, of your guitar teacher, of your plumber, whatever you wanted to comment, you had access. The scale was enormous. Okay? As of December 31st, 2013, there were 50 million businesses who were subject to reviews. There were over 66 million reviews. Okay? And the reason I say that is put into perspective with the release of 2,000 unverified accusations. The 2,000 unverified accusations, they were good enough to summarize in Exhibit 6 to the amended complaint. 500 of those had nothing to do with either of the two issues they raised. And very importantly, for materiality purposes, 700 of those had been released 2 years earlier from a different FOIA request. And we know that materiality turns on a significant alteration in the mix of information available to investors.
Well, I guess I don't see why you think this is terribly helpful for you. I mean, that August or April 2nd, whatever that day was, and that wasn't a good day for your client. Come on. I mean, nobody wants to have a reveal to the public that there are thousands of complaints about this.
No, what we're talking about is Yelp itself, as you noted, had anticipated this and had several times.
Right, so it's concerned everyone's worst fears about the shady practices your client was engaged in. So it's not a good day. April 2nd was not a great day.
It did not alter.
And ran around saying, hey, this is wonderful news. Look what the FTC has discussed. So I don't know why you're taking up time going through this, because I actually think this is not helpful for you. Maybe you should shift to the actual arguments that are in play. That would be more helpful.
Well, Judge Tiger dismissed on materiality as well as loss causation, scienter, and falsity. Okay. I'll move on from materiality, although I do think it's quite important.
The analyst reports that came out contemporaneously thought there was some significance.
The analyst reports said these are unverified accusations. So let me turn to loss causation. You flagged that as an issue. The Ninth Circuit standard under Luce is that you need a drop in the stock price, and it has to be caused by the revelation of fraud. Potential for fraud, possibility of fraud, accusations of fraud are not enough. That's what Luce holds. And in this case, you had nothing but accusations. There is no corrective disclosure, which is really the hallmark of most issuer 10b-5 cases in which there is a corrective disclosure. There was never a corrective disclosure here. There was never a finding by a regulator. And for example, one of the cases, Justice Gould just wrote an opinion in Tosa Genetics. Tosa Genetics is a classic loss causation case because the issuer's management had said our products are cleared by the FDA, and the FDA then sends a letter disputing that, and the company has to recall a whole line of products. The recall of the whole line of products is the corrective disclosure that established loss causation in a dose of genetics. There's no such thing here. Okay? And as you pointed out, that Wall Street Journal article in the 2000 complaints, by the way, accumulated over 6 years, not a 1 year, 6 year range of complaints, had come out. Let's say Yelp said, we're going to conduct an internal investigation to determine whether or not these things have any substance or not, and the stock price goes down. The cases in the Ninth Circuit are crystal clear that's not enough for loss causation.
But wasn't there a lot of inside selling? I don't know about that, but we're discussing here.
There was a lot of inside selling, however, the records show that the inside selling occurred in equal amounts before the class period and after the class period. And it's very interesting to think about the nonsense involved in inside selling. The classic inside selling case is the company knows it's going to release bad information, and the insiders dump their stock before they release the bad information. What here is there's no tying in the allegations between our people knowing that there were going to be these complaints released through a FOIA request. So they couldn't have anticipated the bad information and sold the stock. And that's why the stock selling in this case is completely irrelevant, on top of the fact that the people were selling equal amounts before and after, and almost all of them pursuant to an NB5-1 plan, which allows insiders to sell fixed amounts over a period of time without regard to the news. In other words, your stockbroker is told you're going to sell 10,000 shares a month, irregardless of the news. And that's a safe harbor under the federal securities laws, under 10B51. All these people with significant sales in this case had 10B51 plans. And as Justice Watford pointed out, in the hypothetical, if the Wall Street Journal article and the FOIA information had been revealed, and the FTC said, we're going to launch an investigation, or even file a complaint, even if they had filed a complaint, it would not be enough for loss causation, because it simply is the potential for fraud, not the actual finding of fraud. And I want to come back to see it.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, if I may. And by the way, we appreciate the raise, but we're judges, not justices. So here's my question. Does the record show an answer to my query to your friend on the other side of the case as to whether the FTC ever sent a subpoena to Yelp about their marketing practices?
During the pendency of this case, we put it into the record in the second motion to dismiss, the FTC announced, told Yelp, and Yelp announced that the FTC was not going to pursue any investigation or charges against Yelp. And they, although they may very well have requested documents, they very well may have done some private, non-public investigation, it was undisputed in the record that during the pendency of this case, it was announced they were not going to do anything, and they haven't done anything since. There's never been a finding by anybody, not by a court, not by a regulator, not by anybody, even in private litigation, that the allegation that Yelp tied advertising to reviews is true. Never.
Okay, let me just ask you a pause right there, because that is the one thing, I guess, that seems sympathetic about the plaintiff's argument, is that they're saying, well, you're basically requiring us to prove, right, before we can even get past the 12B6 motion, prove the existence of these kinds of practices in the company, and how could we possibly be expected to do that without the benefit of any discovery? So how would a plaintiff ever prove that and ever plead if that's the role that Jack
covers? Let me answer that in two ways. First of all, the PSLRA was specifically designed to address your question, and it says you have to prove with specificity. You can't do it on information and belief, and you can't do it on the basis of third-party accusations. Remember, these are not plaintiff's allegations. Plaintiff wasn't a customer. Plaintiff wasn't a business. Plaintiff is relying, in this case, 100% on unverified, mostly anonymous, third-party submissions to the FTC. That's not enough. But the second answer to your question is this. In a typical 10b-5 case, the knowledge of those practices comes in two or three ways. One, it comes from corrective disclosures, where a company says, we admit it's a problem. Okay. The second way it comes is from confidential witnesses with personal knowledge and information about the company's practices. Many of the cases that are cited by the plaintiffs in this case use inside confidential witnesses to establish the minimum cleaning requirements of the PSLRA. That's the answer to your question about what they're expected to do.
So if the Wall Street Journal article, instead of reporting on a collection of complaints in an FTC database. I don't get interviewed again, I guess, and former Yelp sales folks who said, yeah, this is exactly what we did and what we were told to do, right, the same exact underlying misconduct. If that had been the basis for the Wall Street Journal article and the stock had plunged, then you would say that they had proof.
It would have to be in their pleadings and not in the Wall Street Journal. If they said, we've interviewed confidential witness one, management instructed to do this, or confidential witness two, who is trained to do this level of extortion, or confidential witness three that saw it happening. None of that is here. In fact, if you actually go to Exhibit 6, which is the summary of all these claims, 90% of the ones that have anything to do with advertising are based nothing but inference. Our reviews changed. You know, there are, as Judge Tiger found in his opinion, maybe 7 or 8 that even cite to an unnamed Yelp salesperson, and not one of them ever connects that to management.
Yeah, I know, but, I mean, come on, if you know, 1,000 people have the same thing happen to them, or, oh, it's just a coincidence that when, you know, a week after we told the Yelp salesperson, no, we're not interested, all of a sudden all my 5-star reviews just disappeared, or some new, negative 1-star review appeared. After a while, you say that's probably not a coincidence that this kept happening over and over again.
Well, if Yelp did not have 50 million businesses on its platform, maybe a couple, 10, 20 people who said something like that might have credibility. Yelp has a filtering mechanism that constantly changes reviews, even without a call by advertising. If some business went to their reviews, they would change from time to time, even if they had never gotten a call asking them to advertise. And that was never tied, you know, the allegations here were never tied to anything. And in fact, the only case that ever addressed this, the Levitt case, which we cited, which was a state court case, found that there was nothing. And the last thing I would say on that point, which is really a very interesting point, at the end of the Wall Street Journal article that is the foundation of this loss causation, they report on a Harvard study by a Harvard Business Administration professor who studied 3,000 businesses and some hundreds of thousands of reviews and concluded objectively that there was no evidence of a tie between advertising. And I thought that was interesting because they completely ignored that part of the Wall Street Journal article. One last point on the Wall Street Journal article I want to make. In the amended complaint, they cited to an academic who had supposedly done an event study. And the event study said it was the Wall Street Journal article of April 2nd, which was the causation of the loss. Now, Mr. Love has completely altered that position, but that what's in the operative pleading is that allegation. And Judge Tiger saw on the article itself that it didn't come out until 4:23 p.m. Eastern Time, which is after the market closed, and it had already reported on a 6% decline. So that was completely bogus event study, but that was the one that was relied on in the amended complaint.
Great. Now, you pointed out that the shortcomings of the complaint in your view, and how some of those things may have been corrected, then, isn't it logical then that the district court was did not exercise their appropriate discretion when it declined to allow an additional amendment? In other words, the second amendment was amended complaint was dismissed with sanctions. Was that really appropriate?
Well, they had 2 chances, right? We litigated 1 complaint that was dismissed. They got a 2nd chance to file the amended complaint. We litigated that again. What's critical about asking for leave to file a 3rd amendment is you're supposed to tell the court how you're going to fix your pleading. And they never did that. They never did that until they asked for reconsideration of Judge Tiger. So it's very important that when they asked for leave to amend with their opposition to our 2nd motion, they didn't say anything about how they were going to fix their complaint.
And counsel, as I understand it, when they filed their motion seeking to amend, they didn't at that time attach a second amended complaint or say what they would amend.
That's correct.
About that with the motion to reconsider later.
That's correct.
And Judge Steiger denied the motion for reconsideration. And I would say that if you look at the pleadings here, they say that the second amended complaint is merely contains all the operative facts in the operative complaint. They don't really point out how it would have changed the court's opinion. And I think you go down a very dangerous road if you start addressing a court's discretion to allow amendment when he's already allowed one. And
also, I think that probably took you over your time limit with my question, but of Judge Watford and Judge Sands don't object, I'd like to ask you to at least take 60 seconds to address the Sander issue, the big picture on that issue.
Sure. So the Sander issue here really has two elements. The first thing that they pleaded in Sander was what we call the core operations inference, that if the senior members of management were running the core operations of the company and the issue in question involves the core operations, then you must assume that they had Sander. Here's the problem with that. Ninth Circuit cases, South Ferry in particular, Metzler as well, say you need, and this is quoting from South Ferry, additional detailed allegations about defendant's exposure to information. Metzler says specific information conveyed to management related to fraud. Okay? What you would have to show here is that management knew not only that these sales reps might have been trying to extort advertising, and there's no evidence that they knew that, and secondly, that it was of such a significance as to threaten the financial performance of the company. Because knowing that there are just a few rogue salesmen in any company is not enough to threaten your financial performance and make it material. So I think they failed on alleging the proper elements of the core operations inference. And the second area that we talked about were the stock sales. I mean, the stock sales were nonsense in the beginning because they couldn't have anticipated the release of the FOIA data. But even secondly, the sales of stock, and we presented charts and graphs to the lower court, were very consistent. Sales before the class period, sales during the class period, sales after the class period, and very substantial holdings at the end. This is not a case where people dumped most of their holdings of the stock. They sold a lot of stock, and it was worth a lot of money, but they still had very, very substantial holdings of Yelp stock at the end of the class period. Thank you, counsel.
Appreciate your argument. Let's give the counsel 2 minutes for a vote.
A lot to cover there, but I'd like to go back, Judge Watford, to, I thought you were onto something when you were talking about confidential witnesses and the analogy there, because regardless of whether the FTC investigates, comes to some conclusion, what we have is a majority of 2,000, essentially, witness statements, and opposing counsel said these are all anonymous. They were not anonymous, as we pleaded in paragraph 37 and 38 of the complaint. These were identifying information. They talked about the time they were made, the location, who they were. Over 200 of them named the Yelp representative. We have, as I said before, counsel concedes that 30 of them included admissions from Yelp representatives themselves that there was a connection.
Well,
and so it's,
I think his point was just that these are customers of the company, not company insiders, right? So, yeah, you're right. The customers are reporting that that's what Yelp says versus the told them.
But we're at the pleading stage, Your Honor. And so the facts are, should be accepted as true, and we get the inferences. And these aren't the sort of customers, they're more potential clients. That's a little different. But if these were considered as if they were
a lawsuit, counsel, in a normal lawsuit, it wasn't a fraud lawsuit or a securities lawsuit, you'd be on very strong ground with an allegation that you'd get a chance to do discovery on. But in a securities fraud context, you have to satisfy both 9B of the federal rules for specificity and also the PSLRA, which requires some strong showing of scienter. And I guess I have a question as to how you can do that from complaints to the FTC if you don't have evidence of some manager who's blowing the whistle on the company or something comparable to that.
So there's specificity and there's plausibility. So, yes, under 9B of the PSLRA, we require specificity, which I believe we have done by detailing these witness, the witness of the witness complaints. And although we don't have admission from Yelp itself, there are actually two declarations or statements from a Yelp reviewer and a lawyer who reviewed, was a reviewer. A lead Yelper is called to also describe this quid pro quo between advertising and reviews. And so if you put all those together, and we get the inferences, it's possible that what the defendants were saying was not true. There's lease, but then there's CBB. And so there was a subpoena that disclosed the risk, and it was much later there was confirmation that that was actually a problem. And here what we have are the complaints, which disclosed the risk, and then the next day or that evening, as these complaints were reviewed, showed that confirmed speculation. And as in the most recent case of Cutler versus Kirchner, for loss causation, says the court looks whether a misstatement caused loss by asking whether the subsequent public disclosures revealed or at least suggested the truth. And that's what we have here. We don't have to prove the truth at this stage of the proceeding, that this wide array of complaints suggested the truth that Yelp, in fact, was manipulating reviews. And the FTC complaints, I think there's also evidence that just the tip of the iceberg. Those are the people who actually went through this formal process of identifying themselves and they got this detailed application, which suggests it's a much wider group of people who have these complaints but aren't going to bother with the process.
Okay. Thank you very much. Counsel, the case just started to stand submitted.